Lucky Pear, Part 1, Hans Christian Andersen, Chapter 1. In the most fashionable street in the city stood a fine old house. The wall around it had bits of glass worked into it, so that when the sun or the moon shone, it looked as if it were covered with diamonds. That was a sign of wealth, and there was great wealth inside. It was said that the merchant was a man rich enough to put 2 barrels of gold into his best parlor, and could even put a barrel of gold pieces, as a savings bank against the future, outside the door of the room where his little son was born. When the baby arrived in the rich house, there was great joy from the cellar up to the garret, and up there, there was still greater joy, an hour or two later. The warehouseman and his wife lived in the garret, and there too, at the same time, a little son arrived, given by our Lord, brought by the stork, and exhibited by the mother. And there, too, was a barrel outside the door, quite accidentally. But it was not a barrel of gold. It was a barrel of sweepings. The rich merchant was a very kind, fine man. His wife, delicate and always dressed in clothes of high quality, was pious, and besides was kind and good to the poor. Everybody rejoiced with these 2 people on now having a little son who would grow up and be rich and happy like his father. When the little boy was baptized, he was called Felix, which in Latin means lucky. And this he was, and his parents were even more so. The warehouse man, a fellow who was really good to the core, and his wife, an honest and industrious woman, were well liked by all who knew them. How lucky they were to have their little boy. He was called Pier. The boy on the first floor and the boy in the garret each received the same amount of kisses from his parents and just as much sunshine from our Lord. But still, they were placed a little differently, one downstairs and one up. Pier sat the highest, way up in the garret, and he had his own mother for a nurse. Little Felix had a stranger for his nurse, but she was good and honest. That was written in her service book. The rich child had a pretty baby carriage, which was pushed about by his elegantly dressed nurse. The child from the garret was carried in the arms of his own mother, both when she was in her Sunday clothes and when she had her everyday things on, and he was just as happy. Both children soon began to observe things. They were growing, and both could show with their hands how tall they were and say single words in their mother tongue. They were equally handsome and petted, and equally fond of sweets. As they grew up, they both got an equal amount of pleasure out of the merchant's horses and carriages. Felix was allowed to sit by the coachman, along with his nurse, and look at the horses. He would fancy himself driving. Pier was allowed to sit at the garret window and look down into the yard when the master and mistress went out to drive. And when they'd left, he'd place 2 chairs, one in front of the other, up there in the room, and so he would drive himself. He was a real coachman. That was a little more than fancying himself to be the coachman. They got along splendidly, these two. Yet it was not until they were 2 years old that they spoke to each other. Felix was always elegantly dressed in silk and velvet, with bare knees, after the English style. "The poor child will freeze," said the family in the garret. Pier had trousers that came down to his ankles, but one day his clothes were torn right across his knees, so that he got as much of a draft and just as much undressed as the merchant's delicate little boy. Felix came along with his mother, and was about to go out through the gate when Pier came along with his, and wanted to go in. "Give little Pier your hand," said the merchant's wife. "You two should talk to each other." And one said, "Pier," and the other said, "Felix." Yes, and that was all they said at that time. The rich lady coddled her boy, but there was one who coddled Pier just as much, and that was his grandmother. She was weak-sided, and yet she saw much more in little Pier than his father or mother could see. Yes, more than any person could. "The sweet child," she said, is surely going to get on in the world. He was born with a gold apple in his hand. I can see it even with my poor sight. Why, there's the shining apple. And she kissed the child's little hand. His parents could see nothing, and neither could Pear. But as he grew to have more understanding, he liked to believe it. That's such a story, such a fairy tale that grandmother tells, said the parents. Yes, grandmother could tell stories, and Pierre was never tired of hearing always the same ones. She taught him a psalm, and the Lord's Prayer as well, and he could say it, not as gabble, but as words that meant something. She explained every single sentence in it to him. He gave particular thought to what grandmother said about the words, "Give us this day our daily bread." He was to understand that it was necessary for one to get wheat bread, for another to get black bread. One must have a great house when he had many people in his employ. Another, in small circumstances, could live quite as happily in a little room in the garret. So each person has what he calls daily bread. Pierre, of course, had his good daily bread, and the most delightful days, too, but they were not to last forever. The sad years of war began. The young men were to go away, and the older men as well. Pierre's father was among those who were called in, and soon afterward it was heard that he'd been one of the first to fall in battle against the superior enemy. There was bitter grief in the little room in the garret. The mother cried. The grandmother and little Pierre cried. And every time one of the neighbors came up to see them, they talked about Papa. And then they all cried together. The widow, meanwhile, was given permission to stay in her garret flat, rent-free, during the first year. And afterward, she was to pay only a small rent. The grandmother stayed with the mother, who supported herself by washing for several single elegant gentlemen, as she called them. Pierre had neither sorrow nor want. He had plenty of food and drink, and grandmother told him stories, such strange and wonderful ones about the wide world, that he asked her one day if the two of them might not go to foreign lands some Sunday and return home as prince and princess wearing gold crowns. "I'm too old for that," said grandmother. "And you must first learn a good many things and become big and strong. But you must always be a good and affectionate child, as you are now." Pierre rode around the room on hobby horses. He had two such horses. But the merchant's son had a real live horse. It was so small that it might well have been called a baby horse, which in fact Pierre called it, and it never could become any bigger. Felix rode it in the yard. Yes, and he even rode it outside the gate when his father and a riding master from the king's stable were with him. For the first half hour, Pierre had not liked his horses and hadn't ridden them, for they were not real. And then he had asked his mother why he could not have a real horse like little Felix had. And his mother said, "Felix lives down on the first floor, close by the stables, but you live high up under the roof. One cannot have horses up in the garret, except like those you have. You should ride on them." And so now Pierre rode, first to the chest of drawers, the great mountain with its many treasures. Both Peter's Sunday clothes and his mother's were there, and there were the shining silver dollars that she laid aside for rent. Then he rode to the stove, which he called the Black Bear. It slept all summer long. But when winter came, it had to be useful to warm the room and cook the meals. Pear had a godfather who usually came there every Sunday during the winter and got a good warm meal. Things had gone wrong for him, said the mother and the grandmother. He had begun as a coachman. He'd been drinking and had fallen asleep at his post, and that neither a soldier nor a coachman should do. He then had become a cabman and driven a cab, or sometimes a carriage, and often for very elegant people. But now he drove a garbage wagon and went from door to door, swinging his rattle, snor-ro-ro-ro-oot, and from all the houses came the servant girls and housewives with their buckets full and turned these into the wagon, rubbish and junk, ashes and sweepings were all thrown in. One day, Pear came down from the garret after his mother had gone to town. He stood at the open gate, and there outside was Godfather with his wagon. "Would you like to take a drive?" he asked. Yes, Pear was willing to indeed, but only as far as the corner. His eyes shone as he sat on the seat with Godfather and was allowed to hold the whip. Pear drove the real-life horses, drove right to the corner. Then his mother came along. She looked rather dubious, for it was not very nice to see her own little son riding on a garbage wagon. She told him to get down at once. Still, she thanked Godfather, but at home, she forbade Pear to drive with him again. One day, he again went down to the gate. There was no Godfather there to tempt him with a drive, but there were other temptations. 3 or 4 small street urchins were down in the gutter, poking about to see what they could find that had been lost or had hidden itself there. Frequently, they'd found a button or a copper coin, but frequently, too, they'd cut themselves on a broken bottle or prick themselves with a pin, which just now was the case. Pierce simply had to join them, and when he got down among the gutter stones, he found a silver coin. Another day, he was again down digging with the other boys. They only got dirty fingers. He found a gold ring, and then with sparkling eyes showed off his lucky find, whereupon the others threw dirt at him and called him Lucky Pear. They wouldn't permit him to be with them any more when they poked in the gutter. Back of the merchant's yard, there was some low ground that was to be filled up for building lots. Gravel and ashes were carted and dumped out there, great heaps of it. Godfather helped deliver it in his wagon, but Pear wasn't allowed to drive with him. The street urchins dug in the heaps, dug with a stick and with their bare hands. They always found one thing or another that seemed worth picking up. Then little Pear came along. They saw him and cried, "Get away from here, Lucky Pear!" And when, despite this, he came closer, they threw lumps of dirt at him. One of these struck against his wooden shoe and crumbled to pieces. Something shining rolled out, and Pear picked it up. It was a heart made of amber. He ran home with it. The other boys didn't notice that even when they threw dirt at him, he was a child of luck. The silver coin he'd found was put away in his savings bank. The ring and the amber heart were shown to the merchant's wife downstairs because the mother wanted to know if they were lost articles that should be returned to the police. How the eyes of the merchant's wife shone on seeing the ring. It was her own engagement ring, one that she lost 3 years before. That's how long it had lain in the gutter. Pear was well rewarded, and the money rattled in his little box. The amber heart was a cheap thing, the lady said. Pear might just as well keep that. At night, the amber heart lay on the bureau, and the grandmother lay in bed. "My, what is that that burns so?" she said. "It looks as if a small candle is lighted there." She got up to see, and it was the little heart of amber. Yes, grandmother, with her weak sight, frequently saw more than anyone else could see. She had her own thoughts about it. The next morning she took a narrow, strong ribbon, drew it through the opening at the top of the heart, and put it around her little grandson's neck. "You must never take it off, except to put a new ribbon around it, and you must not show it to the other boys either, for then they would take it from you, and you would get a stomach ache." That was the only painful sickness little Pear had known so far. There was a strange power, too, in that heart. Grandmother showed him that when she rubbed it with her hand, and a little straw was put next to it, the straw seemed to be alive, and was drawn to the heart of amber and wouldn't let go. Chapter 2. The merchant's son had a private tutor who taught him his lessons, and who took walks with him, too. Pear was also to have an education, so he went to public school with a great number of other boys. They played together, and that was much more fun than going along with a tutor. Pierre would not have changed places with him. He was a lucky Pierre. But Godfather was also a lucky Pierre, although his name was not Pierre. He won a prize in the lottery of $200 on a ticket he shared with 11 others. He immediately bought some better clothes, and he looked very well in them. Luck never comes alone. It always has company, and so it did this time. Godfather gave up the garbage wagon and joined the theater. "What's that?" said Grandmother. "Is he going into the theater?" "As what?" "As a machinist." That was an advancement. He became quite another person, and he enjoyed the plays very much, although he always saw them from the top or from the side. Most wonderful was the ballet, but that gave him the hardest work, and there was always danger of fire. They danced both in heaven and on earth. That was something for little Pierre to see. And one evening, when there was to be a dress rehearsal of a new ballet, in which everyone was dressed and made up as on the opening night, when people pay to see all the magnificence, he had permission to bring Pierre with him and put him in a place where he could see the whole show. It was a biblical ballet. Samson. The Philistines danced about him, and he tumbled the whole house down over them and himself. But there were both fire engines and firemen on hand in case of any accident. Pierre had never seen a stage play, not to mention a ballet. He put on his Sunday clothes and went with Godfather to the theater. It was just like a great drying loft, with many curtains and screens, big openings in the floor, lamps and lights. There were so many tricky nooks and corners everywhere, from which people appeared just as in a great church with its gallery pews. Pierre was seated down where the floor slanted steeply and was told to stay there until it was all finished and he was sent for. He had 3 sandwiches in his pocket so that he didn't need to starve. Soon it grew lighter and lighter. Then up in front, just as if straight out of the earth, there came a number of musicians with both flutes and violins. In the seats next to Pierre sat people dressed in street clothes. But there also appeared knights with gold helmets, beautiful maidens in gauze and flowers, even angels all in white with wings on their backs. They seated themselves upstairs and downstairs, on the floor and in the balcony seats, to watch what was going on. They were all members of the ballet, but Pierre didn't know that. He thought they belonged in the fairy tales his grandmother had told him about. There then appeared a woman, and she was the most beautiful of all, with a gold helmet and spear. She seemed to be above all the others, and sat between an angel and a troll. Now, how much there was to see, and yet the ballet had not even begun. Suddenly, everything became quiet. A man dressed in black moved a little fairy wand over all the musicians, and then they began to play. The music made a whistling sound through the theater, and the whole wall in front began to rise. One looked into a flower garden, where the sun shone and all the people danced and leaped. Such a wonderful sight Pierre had never imagined. There were soldiers marching, and there was war, and there was a banquet, and there was the mighty Samson and his lover. But she was as wicked as she was beautiful. She betrayed him. The Philistines plucked his eyes out. He was forced to grind in the mill and to be mocked and insulted in the great banquet hall. But then he took hold of the heavy stone pillars that held up the roof and shook them, and the whole house fell. It fell, and there burst forth wonderful flames of red and green fire. Pierre could have sat there his whole life long and looked on, even if the sandwiches were all eaten. And they were all eaten. Now, here was something to tell about when he got home. It was impossible to get him to go to bed. He stood on one leg and laid the other on the table. That was what Samson's lover and all the other ladies had done. He made a treadmill out of grandmother's chair and upset two chairs and a pillow over himself to show how the banquet hall had come down. He showed this, yes, and he even presented it with the music that belonged to it. There was no talking in the ballet. He sang high and low, with words and without words, and it was quite incoherent. It was like a whole opera. The most noticeable thing of all, meanwhile, was his beautiful, bell-clear voice, but no one spoke of that. Pierre previously had wanted to be a grocer's boy, to be in charge of prunes and powdered sugar. Now he found there was something much more wonderful, and that was to get into the Samson story and dance in the ballet. A great many poor children had taken that road, said the grandmother, and had become fine and honored people. Yet no little girl of her family would ever be permitted to do so. But a boy, well, he stood more firmly. Pierre had not seen a single one of the little girls fall down before the whole house fell, and then they all fell together, he said. Chapter 3. Pierre wanted to, and felt he must, be a ballet dancer. He gives me no rest, said his mother. At last, his grandmother promised to take him to the ballet master, who was a fine gentleman, and had his own house, like the merchant. Would Pierre ever be that rich? Nothing is impossible for our Lord. Pierre had been born with a golden apple. Luck had been laid in his hands. Perhaps it was also in his legs. Pierre went to the ballet master and knew him at once. It was Samson himself. His eyes had not suffered at all at the hands of the Philistines. That was only acting in the play, he was told. And Samson looked kindly and pleasantly at him and told him to stand up straight, look right at him, and show him his ankle. Pierre showed his whole foot and leg, too. So he got a place in the ballet, said grandmother. This was easily arranged with the ballet master. But before that, his mother and grandmother had spoken with several understanding people, first with the merchant's wife, who thought it a good career for a handsome, honest boy like Pierre, but without any future. Then they'd spoken with Miss Franson. She knew all about the ballet, and at one time, in grandmother's younger days, she'd been the most beautiful danseuse at the theater. She'd danced goddesses and princesses, had been cheered and applauded wherever she'd gone. But then she'd grown older, we all do, and so no longer had she been given principal parts. She'd had to dance behind the younger ones. And when finally her dancing days had come to an end, she had become a wardrobe woman and dressed the others as goddesses and princesses. So it goes, said Miss Franson. The theater road is a delightful one to travel, but it's full of thorns. Jealousy grows there. Jealousy. That was a word Pierre didn't understand at all, but he came to understand it in time. No force or power can keep him from the ballet, said his mother. A pious Christian child, that he is, said grandmother. And well brought up, said Miss Franson. Well formed and moral. That I was in my heyday. And so Pierre went to the dancing school and got some summer clothes and thin-soled dancing shoes to make himself lighter. All the older girl dancers kissed him and said that he was a boy good enough to eat. He had to stand up, stick his legs out, and hold onto a post so as not to fall, while he learned to kick, first with his right leg, then with his left. It was not nearly so difficult for him as it was for most of the others. The ballet master patted him and said that he would soon be in the ballet. He was to play the child of a king who was carried on shields and wore a gold crown. This was practiced at the dancing school and rehearsed at the theater itself. The mother and grandmother had to see little Pierre in all his glory. And when they saw this, they both cried, although it was such a happy occasion. Pierre, in all his pomp and glory, didn't see them at all, but he did see the merchant's family, who sat in the loge nearest the stage. Little Felix was with them in his best clothes. He wore button gloves, just like a grown-up gentleman. And although he could see perfectly well, he looked through an opera glass the whole evening, just like a grown-up gentleman. He looked at Pear, and Pear looked at him. Pear was a king's child with a crown of gold. This evening brought the two children into closer relationship with one another. A few days later, when they met each other at home in the yard, Felix went up to Pear and told him he'd seen him where he was a prince. He knew very well that he was not a prince any longer, but then he'd worn a prince's clothes and a gold crown. "I shall wear them again on Sunday," said Pear. Felix didn't see him Sunday, but he thought about it the whole evening. He would have liked very much to have been in Pear's place. He hadn't heard Miss Franson's warning that the road of the theater was a thorny one, and that jealousy grew along it. Nor did Pear know this yet, but he would soon, very soon, learn it. His young companions, the dancing children, were not at all so good as they ought to be, although they often played angels and had wings on them. There was a little girl, Mala Knallerup, who always, when she was dressed as a page and Pear was a page, stepped maliciously on the side of his foot so as to dirty his stockings. There was a wicked boy who always was sticking pins in his back, and one day he ate Pear's sandwiches by mistake. But that was impossible, for Pear had meatballs on his sandwiches, and the other boy had only bread without butter. He could not have made a mistake. It would be impossible to recite all the annoyances that Pear endured in 2 years, and the worst was yet to come. There was a ballet performed called The Vampire. In it, the smallest dancing children were dressed as bats, wearing gray knitted tights that fitted snugly to their bodies. Black gauze wings were stretched from their shoulders. They were to run on tiptoe as if they were light enough to fly, and then they were to whirl around on the floor. Pear could do this especially well, but his trousers and jacket, all of one piece, were old and worn and couldn't stand the strain. So just as he whirled around before the eyes of all the people, there was a rip right down his back, straight from his neck, right down to where the legs are fastened in, and all of his short white shirt could be seen. All the people laughed. Pear felt it and knew what had happened. He whirled and whirled, but it grew worse and worse. People laughed louder and louder. The other vampires laughed with them and whirled into him, and all the more dreadfully when the people clapped and shouted, "Bravo!" "That is for the ripped vampire," said the dancing children, and from then on they always called him Rippy. Pear cried. Miss Franson comforted him. "It's only jealousy," she said. And now Pear knew what jealousy was. Besides the dancing school, they had a regular school at the theater where the children were taught arithmetic and writing, history and geography. Yes, and they were even taught religion, for it's not enough to know how to dance. There's something more important in the world than wearing out dancing shoes. Here, too, Pear was quick, the very quickest of all, and got plenty of good marks. But his fellow students still called him Rippy. They were only teasing him, but at last he couldn't stand it any longer, and he swung and hit one of the boys, so that he was black and blue under the left eye, and had to have grease paint on it in the evening when he appeared in the ballet. Pear got a scolding from the dancing master, and a worse one from the sweeping woman, for it was her son he'd given a sweeping. End of part 1.